and welcome back to Winged and Ready. I am very, very excited. Of course, I'm always excited to be recording with all of the smart and clever people that we have on as guests, but today we're fortunate to have a repeat guest, Paul Shao. He is an asset allocation analyst in our chief investment office. You may remember about a year ago, we had him on to go over the CEO macro briefing book, and he is on again to go over our CEO macro briefing book for the next half of 2025. But this is particularly timely because we're going to be going over insights for taxes. Paul, why don't you say a couple words about yourself as an introduction and then tee up this insight for taxes before I start asking you a bunch of questions.
Absolutely. Thanks, Diane. Maybe a little bit about me. I'm part of the Chief Investment Office, a part of UBS Wealth Management in the asset allocation team. We really try to look at the big sort of economic and market trends and make the best sort of portfolio decisions for our clients for that. To complement those efforts, we've started a publication series called the CEO Macro Briefing Book, specifically for our business owner clients and related FAs. And I think it's been quite successful. In speaking with marketing, it's one of the most read publications as part of CIO, so that's always good to hear. Coming into this year, there have been a lot more questions, anxiety about the One Big Beautiful Bill, the important tax legislation that the White House and Congress just passed. So we thought we'd make a publication dealing with some of the most frequent questions that we hear from clients and just answering them.
That's perfect. And I think because it is a mouthful and some people may debate on its beauty, I'm just going to call it the OBBB. Is that okay with you?
Sure. Perfect.
So this is so perfect, again, going into the second half of the year. As a financial advisor, this is really when we want to make sure people are have all their I's dotted and their T's crossed as far as planning goes, going towards the end of the tax planning year. And this is really, really honed in on business owners. I've had a couple of podcasts right before this, one with our good friend James Jack, and we were really talking about the great need and really requirement for business owners to be proactive in their planning when it comes to thinking about an exit. But this, even more so, is just planning that you really need to do to be aware of how the OBBB impacts your business and what business owners should consider as a result. High level, before I dig into the specific questions, would you give this a rating or an overview as being hugely onerous, impactful, or some other descriptive for business owners? If you had a business owner in an elevator, what would you tell them their reaction should be to the OBBB?
As a business owner, I'd say relief. For one, in an era where policy can be quite uncertain, I think the OBBB gives business owners, as well as a lot of households, a degree of certainty when it comes to tax policy. And the reason why I say that is because back in President Trump's first term in 2017, there was a bill passed that arguably was his most important legislative accomplishment, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, or TCJA, that change a lot of tax provisions, but they're only temporary, set to expire either in 2025 and 2026, depending on those provisions. So a really important thing that the OBBB does is extend those provisions. A lot of them have been made permanent. They've made the tax codes, in some respects, simpler for business owners and also solidifies a lot of deductions that could minimize tax bills for business owners who are looking to exit or just looking to plan for next year.
Okay, perfect. Let's dig into that a little bit more deeply. Can you tell me what some of the goodies business owners should be aware of?
Absolutely. I think a couple of things, right? For the first and perhaps most important one is the 20% qualified business income provision. That was a temporary measure that was in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in 2017, and that's now made permanent. That's particularly affecting LLCs, proprietorships, S-Corps, anything that has a pass-through income. So that original deduction has been made permanent. One thing that smaller businesses might be interested in is a measure that would cut red tape, which is an increase 1099 threshold, which basically means that for reporting purposes, anything under, I think, $2,000 doesn't need a separate 109 threshold. That just simplifies the tax process for a lot of small business owners. And when it comes to investments, there's 100% bonus depreciation for qualified capital properties as well as investment that should minimize tax bills, or rather maximize the tax benefits for business owners who want to deduct a particular expense in the near term. There's a lot more. I'd say that in general, a very high level is a lot of measures that were meant to minimize tax bills for business owners have been kept in place. Those are a couple. There have been some changes to giving strategies, as well as when it comes to planning long term for education accounts, TRUMP accounts, that has been changed too. But I think that's more of an individual basis.
I think the qualified small business stock exclusion is particularly important, and one that a lot of businesses haven't looked at QSBS or been aware that they qualified for it. So you're saying, too, that it's got more of a ramp so people can access that QSBS more quickly than before?
Absolutely. That's one thing that I think is quite important for business owners looking to exit and wondering what they can do to minimize their tax burden in doing so. And the QSBS provision from OBBB should be a good deal of relief and something that business owners should cheer on as part of the tax bill.
Yeah, and it's great that you can get it held for 3 years versus the full 5 years as well. So that that waterfall, 3, 4, and 5 years, going from 50, 75 to 100% respectively should be helpful for small business owners. I like it.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about how it can encourage investment. Maybe we'll see something coming back with the qualified opportunity zones, or will it help R&D at all?
Yeah, so I think a couple of ways. One of the ways was that 100% bonus depreciation for related capital investment. I think that should accelerate some capital plans because it does sort of maximize that benefit sooner rather than later. That's one thing. Another thing is that R&E research and experimentation is what it's called instead of R&D development. Expenditures can also be expensed in the current year. And for some small businesses, that can be retroactive as well. So if you spent money on research and expenditures from, I think, 2022 onwards, you might consider revising and looking back at that so you could maximize your tax benefit this year too, given the new provision in the OBBB. And then the final thing is sort of the extension of the qualified opportunity zones. Just to refresh, this was a provision made in the 2017 TCJA, which was also set to expire. So for investors looking to sort of maximize their capital gains, if they put it into a qualified business zone, you had a deferral to pay that tax up until 2026. What OBBB does is make this program permanent, so investors can continue to benefit from that. And instead of having that date of 2026, now those deferrals will be on, I think, a five-year basis in order to get that 10% step up. So these are just provisions that, from a business perspective, I think are meant to incentivize investment, whether it's from deducting your capital expenses this year, incentivizing research and development, and also incentivizing investment in relevant qualified opportunity zones.
That's awesome. I know in the past when the opportunity zones first came out, there was a little bit of a Oz washing, if you will. Does the current bill have more strict criteria to be eligible for a qualified opportunity zone?
It does. So that's one thing that I think was part of the negotiations of that. When it comes to what qualifies an opportunity zone, I think that criteria is a little stricter. But one thing also meant to shift, I think, investment is that there's also more of an incentive to, within the opportunity zone subset, to develop rural, especially agricultural sectors too. So for business owners looking to maximize that sort of tax benefit from related capital gains, that might be an avenue worth pursuing as well.
Oh, that's interesting. Thank you for that. Okay. So we've talked about some changes and we've talked about some things coming back if looking the eligibility being a little bit stricter than before, which is likely a good thing. What hasn't changed?
I think what hasn't changed is what we talked about in the beginning, right? This the whole point of this bill and we the way we sort of modeled it is that the bulk of the bill extends what the provisions made in the TCJA. So those tax brackets, tax rates, that is mostly staying the same. I think for some folks, especially in the deal-making space, was wondering what would be done about the carried interest provision. And sadly, there aren't any changes to that. Another change is that hasn't been changed is the elimination of personal exemptions. I think that was made in the 2017 TCJA. And that also hasn't been changed within the OBBB. So there are a lot of things changing, but I think those sort of key things aren't changing that I think some business owners were looking forward to.
All right. So thank you so much for that. Let's talk a little bit more about how OBBB narrows and may complicate tax credits that are made under IRA.
Yeah. So the IRA I think you're referring to is the Inflation Reduction Act, yep. Not the sort of retirement account. So that's an important distinction.
Yeah.
What some things that the OBBB does, it affects, I think, folks in the manufacturing energy sector is a lot of that clean energy tax credits given within the Inflation Reduction Act signed under the Biden administration. That has been, I wouldn't say fully eliminated, but it definitely has narrowed. I think for a lot of certain clean energy projects, whether it's making your house more efficient, electric vehicles, et cetera, those credits were extended anywhere between, 2030 to 2032. And now that definition has been restricted and you're supposed to make an investment by the latest 2026, depending on what clean energy project that might've been starting. And it has to be in service by 2031 in order to qualify for any sort of clean energy benefit. So the OBBB, one sort of thing that folks should be aware of is that it does narrow the scope of clean energy projects. So for firms that were thinking about having projects in 2028, 2029, 2030, they might want to bring forward those projects right now in order to capture that, maximize those tax credits.
Yeah. It's interesting. The headline of that sounds a little bit on the discouraging side, but I remember Amantya talking from sustainability that when you look at the clean energy and efficiency from wind, it's a pretty small segment in the energy construct. So maybe that creates more opportunity if people are looking away from areas that they think will be impacted by the Inflation Reduction Act and those tax credits being narrowed or reduced or eliminated, that there still could be some opportunity. Do you have any thoughts there or any reactions to that?
I think in general, when it comes to, we had written when the new administration started that sustainability and clean energy in general is just treated differently under this administration versus the previous one. The CHIPS Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, I think expanded a lot of opportunity for sustainability, clean energy firms in the U.S. And we saw that a pickup in manufacturing investment as a result. I think a lot of that has been already front-loaded. So mm-hmm. Now OBBB, in order to mitigate some of the costs, the other parts of the bill has. They did narrow some of those tax credits. It's not going away. It's just that those definitions have been a bit stricter. So for those firms looking to invest, it's worth reconsidering your strategy at this point.
Yeah, that's a good point. Thank you. So you were talking about firms willing to invest. And so how does the bill, what changes are present in the bill for both individuals and firms?
I think we talked a lot about the firm perspective. From the individual perspective, perhaps a couple of things. One is that those tax rates and tax brackets from TCJ, that will not be changed. So for a lot of households, they were going to expect a higher tax bill, I think, this coming year versus if the bill wasn't passed. So when it comes to tax certainty, a lot of that has been extended to, and that should be, in general, a benefit towards towards household spending. Another thing that has been debated was the SALT cap limit, and that hasn't been completely eliminated, but it has been raised from 10,000 to 40,000. So for those in states with high state and local tax, that should be another added benefit. A third change from the corporate and household perspective is just sort of the OBBB changes how taxes are for giving as well as charitable donations. I think a little bit going into the minutiae into this, but in general, when it comes to estate giving, that limit has been, I think, raised to 15 million. So for 99% of those looking to give on their estate, that should exempt them for the grand majority of taxes. And then when it comes to charitable giving, there is, I think, a little more scrutiny for those who itemize their charitable giving. Mm-hmm. And in general, that incentivizes larger gifts, perhaps bunched instead of steadier gifts, smaller gifts across the years.
So make it chunky, make it count.
That's right. In order to get the maximum tax benefit. Yeah. If you want to donate, you can always donate.
Always donate. Always support charities in need. And I'll just add in a good chunky way to do that, too, if you need to do it in a particular year, is setting up a donor advised fund. So happy to discuss that more. If anybody feels like it, just give me a shout and a holler. I'll drop our contact information at the end of this episode. Okay, so let's talk about how this is going to impact growth. Is it going to boost growth? Is it going to be a drag? What does it look like?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. So from an economic perspective, the bill has effects in a couple different ways. One is growth, and the second really is the direction of interest rates. And I think that's something that business owners should be aware of. When it comes to the growth front, the extensions for sort of the goodies for businesses, the tax certainty, the benefits for households, all of that should be positive for growth in the short run. So before the OBBB was passed, we did expect a stronger slowdown in the next couple of quarters due to a lot of those TCJA tax benefit provisions expiring. Mm. Since they're not expiring, that should be growth supportive over the next couple of quarters. And that should be, I guess, good for businesses, especially given how tariffs in general can be growth restricting. So it sort of balances out the negative effects from tariffs. That all said, the bill is expensive. It does add around, I think, $600 billion to the deficit across the next 10 years. So what that means is interest rates in general should be higher than they would be before the bill was passed. So looking past the 2030s to the 2050s, that's when the effect of the bill will start to be growth negative just because of those higher interest rates. Mm. And another thing perhaps to note is while I did talk about tax certainty as a result of this bill, it does put the U.S. debt level on a more unsustainable path. Mm. And it increases the need, it increases the pressure for future Congress, future administrations to raise revenues somehow. So that means down the line, probably some of these things might be repealed. So that's something else that business owners should be aware of, is that tax rates most likely will go up in the long term. So to capture these advantages now that the OBBB has, I think would be certainly something worth talking about.
Yeah, strike while the iron is hot. And putting on my economist hat for a minute, going back multiple decades and multiple presidential terms, I think one thing people often don't look at are these phases that you pointed out, you know, and how the impact of what a president does in their four-year term really is going to, that effect that it's going to have isn't going to be while they're in office. It's going to be when the next president is in office or even the president after that. So I think it's a little bit of a misnomer when people get upset at the current president in seat, you know, going back to the great financial crisis, et cetera, about what was put in place to put those things into motion. So hopefully phase three, to your point, that long-term drag will be rectified. But it is very interesting to see how this can be very expensive, and growth rates will be more modest in the medium to long run. So the planning now for business owners, again, strike while the iron is hot.
Yep, exactly.
So let's dig into that deficit spending a little bit more, going into that long-term view. As it's written today, you said it will increase deficit spending. Dig into that for us.
Sure. So I mentioned a lot of the goodies that the tax bill does present. When the TCJA was passed in 2017, a lot of the impact of the deficit, I think, was widely expected. The difference is, in 2017, the deficit to GDP ratio was around 3%, which is not great, but not super concerning. Now it's double that at 6% of GDP. So what that means is just every year we're just adding more and more to overall debt levels. And that makes the U.S. assets, treasury debt and the dollar, a lot more sensitive to changes in interest rate. So some of that debt is just because of the loss, and some of that addition to the deficit of that $600 billion year on year is just the lost revenue that will come just based on what tax benefit that businesses are taking advantage of. But part of that also is the higher level of interest of debt servicing costs because of those higher interest rates across the years. And I think it's particularly worrying when the amount that we spend on servicing the debt is about the same amount that we spend on defense, and that ratio will only get more misaligned in the coming years.
Yeah. Have you all looked at any other comparable countries in CIO when assessing this? Does this put us on a trajectory to be like Japan or any other country?
When it comes to federal debt and GDP and then taking into the deficit spending, the U.S. looks more like Japan and Greece than other developed nations. But the U.S. is also in a unique position because we're the country with the reserve currency as part as the most used currency as part of the world, mm-hmm. and the credibility of the Federal Reserve is still, I think, unmatched when it comes to other central banks. So, I think the U.S. should be treated as its own special entity when it comes to debt and deficit spending. But that doesn't mean that right now, just based on how fiscal dynamics are working, more economists, including myself, are a little anxious. And I think that has also fed through into markets this year. Early this year, when we had talks of this bill, the idea of tariffs incoming, we had the treasury rates at the longer end, your 30-year rates start rising and worry investors. And that really, reminds us of that sort of James Carville comment about, if I could be reincarnated, I would come back as the bond market because I could bully anybody. So I think that's something that the administration is paying attention to as well.
Yeah, because just looking at the numbers, I think to quote the CIO and your report, you were saying that if the tax changes were made permanent, the debt to GDP levels would top 180% of GDP by 2055. That sounds a long ways away, but when you're doing planning and government spending, 30 years isn't really that long.
Well, yeah, I feel like 1995 wasn't that long ago, but I suppose it is.
Well, let's not talk about that. to the tune of plus 30% of GDP by 2055, that's something to be aware of and will really make all of us need to be acutely tuned into our planning, not only year to year, but in that medium term, I think. Do you think it's fair to say that while we always encourage people to look at time horizons and in multiple different frameworks, that maybe that medium time period has become increasingly more important in today's environment?
Absolutely. From a political perspective, in the medium term, what I think we'll have a new generation of leaders. And I think deficit spending might not be as popular now because those interest costs that I've been talking about will become more and more of a problem for the government. So in the medium to long term, I will expect tax law to be changed once again. So when it comes to planning in the short term, in the medium term, now's the time to really consider your strategies and to take advantage of whatever provisions you can, because I do think that this environment will not be permanent.
Right. Thank you for that. So we know that the fiscal dynamics will be less sustainable, and debt sustainability is at a crossroads, but a lot of people, a lot of press, the media have been talking about credit ratings being under stress. Can you talk about credit ratings and, you know, the collapse of asset values?
Fun topic.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think this came back into vogue recently when Moody's downgraded U.S. debt. It's still investment grade, but the worry is that if the U.S. continues on its spending trajectory, its credit worthiness, it'll be downgraded. So we did have that downgrade, and there has been no change as a result of OBBA, just because it's been largely expected by the markets. But lower credit rating in general, I think, will have an upward pressure for interest rates. You want to demand a higher interest rate from a less creditworthy partner in general. So I think that has, when it comes to businesses, even individuals looking to take out a long-term loan, that long-end loan that might be elevated for quite some time. So it is worth thinking about strategies to mitigate around that. And then when it comes to sustainability, we economists use a framework called the R-G framework, mm-hmm. which is basically, is your interest rate higher than your growth rate? If your growth rate is higher than your interest rate, then it behooves you to take on more debt, because the more you grow, then you are cutting your, let's say, debt to GDP level just by growing faster than your interest rate. But if your interest rate is growing faster than your growth rate, then it compounds your debt servicing costs over time. So right now, when it comes to real interest rates, the U.S. is still on that good part, that G is greater than R, but towards that longer end, 2040s, 2050s, because growth rates will slow down and interest rates will likely be higher than previously expected, that's when we come into trouble. And all things being equal, I think the U.S. credit worthiness will be looked into. There's no level of deficit, no level of debt that is a hard and fast rule that predicts the collapse of asset values, especially when it comes to sovereign debt. So it's not like 150 or 200% of GDP always equals the collapse of asset values. But it is something that increases the risk of that the further along we get into.
And that has a cute little name, doesn't it?
The Minsky moment.
The Minsky moment. Hard to pin it down, but good to be aware of. So
yes.
Not RMB, RNG. It's an important framework for all of us to keep an eye on and make sure that debt to GDP ratio is sustainable. All righty, the U.S. dollar. What is it looking like? Could the OBBB lead to a weaker dollar? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think the dollar has come back into vogue. It was quite strong in 2022, 2023, and then it started softening towards the back end of last year and certainly towards this year, and now trades at the lowest levels in a couple of years. I personally know that from looking at the conversion rate between the euro and one of my favorite countries, the Japanese yen. It's been great to visit over the last couple of years, but a little more expensive now. In general, the OBBB should be another headwind to the dollar, so keep it, or to all things being equal, to make it a little weaker based on that, because it raises sort of international investor, call it anxiety, about the fiscal trajectory. The dollar also has been behaving more and more like a risk asset. Mm. So what I mean by that is, usually in times of economic or market stress, the dollar tends to appreciate because investors, they get out of their risky assets and they just tend to buy the dollar because you have full faith and credit in the U.S. government. Over the last couple of months, the dollar has been much more correlated with the S&P 500. So when the stock market had its correction after Liberation Day, you would expect the dollar to appreciate, but it actually depreciated because the worry comes from the sustainability of U.S. and U.S. growth rather than coming from an elsewhere shock. So OBBB, the passage of OBBB adds to this dollar correlation, with overall risk assets, and it will be a headwind. So for firms that have a lot of revenue exposed to international markets, in general, a weaker dollar should be beneficial for business. But that's certainly something to be aware of. So those strong levels that we saw the dollar in 2022, 2023, are unlikely to be seen in the near term because of the spill.
So I think we should rename your CEO macro briefing book to On the One Hand and On the Other Hand, because we just got to have two economists having a true discussion, looking at what some of the goodies are, but also what some of the dangers are to be aware of in the medium and long term. So this was really helpful for me. I also love that this is truly spelled out in your macro briefing book. So when I post this episode, I'll be sure to make that available to everybody as well. Paul, do you have any closing thoughts for listeners or things that you really want to drive home for us?
Maybe one thing, which is I think 2025 has been the year of policy, whether it comes from the White House when it comes to tariffs or the BBB, Federal Reserve, the debate about when's the next time they'll cut rates. And a lot of that is converging in the second half of this year. So if you were bored by markets and the economy in the first half of this year, I know I certainly wasn't. During the second half of this year, it's when a lot of these narratives that we have been talking about really come into play. So I really urge our listeners, in case they're curious to learn more or they're confused about what's going on, to really utilize all the resources that the Chief Investment Office pumps out, because we're really trying to do our best for ourselves and our clients to keep abreast of everything that's changing right now.
Awesome. And they can find that at ubs.com?
Absolutely.
Awesome. And you can find me either sitting in my Jericho office, which I am presently doing in Jericho, New York, or at 516-745-8964. Alternately, my email is diane.johnston@ubs.com. I am a financial advisor and institutional consultant. And Paul, I cannot thank you enough for today's conversation. It was awesome, as always.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that clients understand the ways in which we conduct business, that they carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide to them about the products or services we offer. For more information, visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG, member FINRA, SIPC.